With 1,000+ archive shows and new shows coming to you every Tuesday, we bring you illuminating people from around the globe. Visit our store for their services and books and enjoy the show. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Choose Positive Living. I'm your host, Sarah Troy, and my guest today is Rob Eastway. The joy of mathematical puzzles. Now, I know you think that anybody is mathematical must be a nerd, and it's only for the brainiacs, but you use math in absolutely everything you do in every aspect of your life, and life is a puzzle that we're constantly trying to put together. Well, he's put some wonderful books together, Why Do Business in Trees, Maths, Mums and Dads, and many other books here that he's put together to kind of serve different levels of the mathematical and making it fun. Something that he's always enjoyed from the beginning of his life. He's kind of always looked at puzzle making, kind of mathematical puzzles intrigued him, and, you know, riddles and quizzes. And I know some people really do very, very well at that. I'm kind of iffy on those. It all depends on what they are. But I'm always unraveling and looking at the puzzle of life and trying to make an understanding of it. So we do use math and puzzles in everything that we do. So let's find out what he's done here and how he's put all of these wonderful books together in helping people actually embrace the joy of mathematical puzzles again. And what's his particular puzzle in life? How does he see life through that mathematical puzzle? Welcome to the show, Rob.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be on.
So, you know, math, a lot of people just frown at, right? You know, you've got the mathematical people where they love it, it's nectar to them, and other people go, oh, math.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, if people think back to their school days, it's probably the subject that most polarizes opinion. You love it or hate it. Mm-hmm. And for many people, for those many who have negative memory of their school mathematics, it's because they remember that feeling of getting it wrong, of being stuck, and very often of having teachers who punish them, sometimes physically, for being unable to do something that made no sense to them. And in fact, you know, by the time many children get into their teens, a lot of the math does become very abstract, and they start, you know, seeing stuff where they think, well, I don't understand what this is, and I can't see how this connects to anything I will do in my life. And that's a terrible situation to be in, where you're studying something you don't understand and you can't see the point of. So I see that all the time with older children and with adults, parents and so on, which is a shame, but a lot to do with the experience that people do have in their school days, unfortunately.
And I was very much one of those people. You know, I'm the creative brain. And you know, I could always see kind of a puzzle of life and people and psychosis, etc. But when it came to actual math, it was a different language to me altogether.
And it's interesting, though. You know, you use the word, you know, creative, and of course, most people would perceive maths as very much not being a creative subject, as being a logical subject. The irony of all this, and you know, where our conversation will go now, is that strangely, I've always seen a lot of maths, and the most interesting maths, is actually being a creative subject where you're trying things out, experimenting and so on, which is of course not the perception people have. So bizarrely, for me, maths is a source of an awful lot of creative possibilities, and is great, but that's a long way from the logical, rigorous discipline that people
taught, right? You know, the way the school introduce it. If you introduce math in that creative way of solving a puzzle and understanding how math, you know, is interactive and, you know, something that you use on a daily basis in everything you do, then I think it becomes something that is more, you know, embraced. And people don't become intimidated with. But as you said, we were punished for it, or you were deemed stupid because you didn't get calculus, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And let me give you another analogy as well, which is relevant here, which is the analogy with music, where, you know, music, anyone who's studied an instrument will remember some of the chores involved of practice, and of particularly doing your scales, you know, just routine practice and practice until you get it right. It's pretty tedious, but it was a useful skill if you wanted to go on and actually play tunes that you liked. The trouble with math in a lot of people's experience, is it's a bit like music, where you only ever get to play the scales. You never get to hear the nice tunes. And of course, the thing about music is most of us love music because we love the tunes. We love, you know, the end product, whether that's Mozart or Pink Floyd or the Beatles or whoever. We like the output, and it's worth the journey because you know where it's going to. For many people, for maths, it never gets beyond the equivalent of doing your scales, and you never see any beauty. And again, you know, what a tragedy that for many people, it's a subject that they would never associate with beauty and all of these other things. So yes, I mean, it's a subject with a bad image, and sometimes deservedly so.
There was a very beautiful Chinese movie that I watched some years ago, and it was called Not One More. And it was about a very rural area where this teacher would teach the kids, and then at night they put all the desks together and sleep on it. And he got called away on a family matter and put one of the kids in charge. And just prior to him going, a child had been taken by the local government because he was a fast runner. And they wanted to put him into sports, you know, for that esteem, as they do. And he said, not one more child will leave, and I will be back. And unfortunately, one child had to leave because the mother was sick, and he had to go into the city to work to support his mother. And he's only around about 9 or 10. And they come up with a way of how to raise money to go to the city to bring him back. And everything that they did, it was a mathematical equation. Even though we were building the blocks, we're raising the money, we're doing this, everything became about math, unbeknownst to them. And it was such a wonderful way of seeing the learning through the necessity, through the application, for reaching an end goal. It was a very beautiful movie, but you know, I think that's where we miss the point of math, isn't it? Is that how we use it every day?
Yeah, and you know, when children are being tested on it, you'll often get questions that kind of look like they may be to do with the real world. You know, there's a ladder leaning at this, what's the angle or whatever. But actually, the way that children encounter the problems is nothing like you encounter it in the real world, because you kind of know it's a math question. You know that they've given the information you're going to need only, and there's no, you know, the situation's been set up for you. And how much more interesting a subject, or any subject, becomes when you're faced by a situation and you think, what do I do now? And in many cases, in life, lots of everyday situations, it turns out that there's some maths involved, some basic calculations, some estimation, from thinking, well, if I plan ahead, what's going to happen if I do this and do that? But it's far more interesting when it's a much more open problem, and you've got to discover what the maths is you're going to need in order to solve it. And that is a far more stimulating way to deal with the subject, and you know, to relate it to situations we care about in life, when we see patterns, when we see, you know, one of my books you mentioned before about, which is a very London British phenomenon, but why do buses come in threes? You wait for ages for a bus, and then three come all at once. You'll find that in New York, you'll find that in congested cities across the world. And it's a pattern that we notice, the question then is, well, why does it happen? And one can investigate and look at the dynamics behind it to say, well, actually, there is a tendency, it's bound to happen, that buses will get drawn together like magnets. It's inevitable part of the way they behave, and timetables behave, and random population turning up at bus stops behaves, and so on. But it's an everyday phenomenon that we all notice and care about if we're waiting for a bus and frustrated, and a far more appealing problem to tackle than one which we don't care about because it just has no bearing on our lives.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you talk about patterns. I mean, you know, people think patterns is just a cloth, you know, pattern on a cloth, on a piece of fabric, or, you know, pattern in a picture. But everything about patterns is an equation, isn't it?
It can be represented. Normally, can be represented with numbers and shapes, for example. So it can be represented mathematically. Even language and its patterns can be sort of, you can codify it in some ways. I mean, sometimes you don't want to take it too far, but it occurs to me, by the way, you know, we've talked a bit about about puzzles and patterns and everything else. I have a little puzzle that is, this is quite a nice puzzle because there is no right answer. Everyone can come up with an answer. You will come up with an answer, and anyone listening to this will come up with an answer. And yet it says an awful lot about the way our brains work. So don't worry if it sounds like an intelligence test type question. It's not. It's a genuine, what's your brain telling you? So are you ready if I
yes.
give you the puzzle? Okay, so it's a bit like one of those non-verbal reasoning questions, it sounds like, but it goes like this. If ABC goes to ABD, what does XYZ go to? So I'll just repeat that. If ABC goes to ABD, what does XYZ go to? So have a thought and say what you think. And remember, there is no wrong answer to this. It's what pattern do you think of when you hear that?
Right, of course, you know, this is one of these puzzles that my mind immediately goes, to.
yeah, except the good news is you don't have to worry. You just think, well, something must happen to XYZ if ABC went to ABD. And as I say, whatever you say is fine, but you might be interested to know what I'm going to guess well over half of your listeners will be thinking right now.
Okay, well, I would go XYZ goes to XYW. God,
oh, interesting. now, what are you able to talk about your reasoning as to why you thought that? Why did you think
a letter out of sorts?
So it was a letter moving backwards.
Yes. Moved forwards with the ABC, but with the XYZ, it can't move forwards, so it has to move backwards.
Right. Okay. You know what? That is a very interesting and quite unusual answer. Bizarrely, the last person who gave me that answer, or something very close to it, was my 7-year-old daughter. Which, but it's also very close to the answer that was that a guy called Douglas Hofstadter came up with, saying if computers were able to think like humans, they would come up with that answer. He actually said, well, you said XYW, and he said W. You said XYW. I think he said WYZ. So right. If the outside one can't keep moving, then the inside one moves inwards, if
right.
you see what I mean.
Right, yes.
I'll tell you what most people who will listen to this now will have been thinking. I can predict it. They will have been thinking XYA. In other words, what comes after Z?
Right.
A. Why do they think
the
that?
Circle.
Because it's like a clock. It goes
right.
back to the start. But right. the thing is, that's what the majority of people think. But it's not what... There's about 30% of people who think of other things. For example, some people think XY1. Why do they say that? Because there's no letters left, so let's start with the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Some people just say XY blank. Why do they say that? Because there's no letters, so it just disappears.
Mm-hmm.
One friend of mine said XYAA. And a lot of people listen to that and think, "Wow, how really creative! That's completely blown the paradigm here." Someone who's introduced a fourth letter—how did she think of that? She thought of that because every day she works with a spreadsheet, and if you go to a spreadsheet, after column Z comes column AA. So she just thought of that pattern.
Right.
So these are all patterns. But you know, how did you come up with your idea? How did other people come up with their idea? It's drawing on patterns you've seen before and saying, well, I think it belongs to this pattern. But of course, there's no right answer.
Right.
It's just, but it's interesting the way the brain works. And I like to use that puzzle to show that, you know, having ideas, which is effectively what you were just having when you said your W answer, is about applying patterns you've seen in the past to what you see now. And that's really what an idea is. And you put two people together, they have different experiences in life, and so they come up with a different pattern that they draw on. And my friend who said XYAA, when I told her, you know, some people say XYA, her reaction was, wow, that's really clever. How did they think of that? Whereas most people would have thought the complete opposite. Well, everyone thinks of XYA. How did you think of XYAA? So I love that for
yes.
for it reflecting the way people you know, come up with ideas and see the world. And you know, that's a sort of mathematical question, but it's a sort of patterns question, and it's a creativity question too.
You know, very often you'll see things posted, like on Facebook, etc., these kind of puzzles. You know, find your name in this puzzle, or find a number, you know, in that lies in it, or can you read backwards? Now, I can find the number and I can read backwards, you know, or even scrambled letters, but I find it a really hard time to kind of find a name, you know, in like a crossword type, puzzle type thing. You know, it's just the certain patterns I can't grasp. They just don't connect. Is this kind of normal with people?
Well, everyone has different strengths and weaknesses. For some people, they're really good with verbal, word, letter problems because their brain is wired that way. For others, it's visual or tactile. So, you know, when it comes to puzzles, there are a vast range of different types of puzzle. I'm very good at mathematical puzzles because I'm so used to them, but I'm pretty hopeless at a lot of physical puzzles, and I'm okay at word puzzles, depends on the puzzle. So, you know, there's no such thing as normal, I guess.
It's just a strength or a weakness.
It's a strength. There's a strength and a weakness and an interest as well. But spotting certain types of word, you know, anagrams, and, you know, there's a TV show that's popular in the UK which presents a lot of clues where they miss out all the vowels and you're just left with the consonants. You've got to say what the word is. Some people find that impossible, and for some reason I often get those quite quickly. I'm thinking, why is my brain picking those out when others are finding it so hard? And of course there's others that I just find almost impossible.
Well, you know the show Countdown in England, which of course has been around for eons. My mother was, you know, that was her program. She had to watch Countdown. She lived to 95, but I would say probably even up to 94, she would still have an 80% average. And she was a crossword word puzzler every day. She would fill out a crossword. Words were her passion. She absolutely loved them. But she was very, very good at kind of the math of, you know, being able to do sums quickly, etc.
And you know,
Countdown is fascinating, isn't it? Because, you know, we can look at it, and I, you know, if I got two or three right during the program, I felt so proud of myself, you know.
And it's a lovely program because it's a letters, find the longest word you can out of these letters and then find a total, get as close to this target total as you can with these numbers. So it was testing two skills. I think actually the really interesting point about your mother, age 94, doing that is that this kind of exercise, I'm sure there is plenty of scientific evidence to support the fact it actually keeps your brain exercised and fresh. So it was great she was doing it, but she was helping herself by doing it too, by keeping that agility. And I mean, my late mother was similar, certainly with numbers. She could, when she actually, you know, she in her final years was really, you know, had lost a lot of memory and a lot of ability to do a lot of things. She could still do mental arithmetic, and it kept her sharp. And you could see she brightened up when she was given a challenge to do, because that part of her brain was still working really well.
Oh, you know, my mum also did puzzles. She also played patience. You know, she was constantly playing cards on her own. You know, didn't mention solitaire, but she was always kind of engaging her mind in something, and you know, like game playing is really important too, isn't it, in keeping the mind sharp, because you have the math in there, you have the puzzles, you have the patterns.
And in fact, when I'm dealing with teenagers and want to engage them in maths, my number one go-to is games, because so many games, firstly, we all enjoy games pretty much, and there are some games everyone likes to play, and many games require mathematical thinking of different types of strategies. I mean, sometimes basic adding up, like adding up your money in Monopoly, but, you know, on a broader level, there you're working out the chances of things. Lots of card games, you're thinking ahead, you're thinking strategically, but in a completely painless or fun kind of way. And there are so many mathematical ideas that I'm able to introduce because we're playing a game, and therefore, you know, the teenagers are working things out, and they're working things out because they want to win,
right.
And they're doing maths with a purpose. So and then, you know, I sort of reveal to them after we've been playing games for a while, well, actually, you're doing skills that are going to really help you in decision making in adult life. So this might have been fun, but it actually turns out to be some of the most important maths you'll ever do. Probably more important, dare I say, than working out Pythagoras and lots of these other things that look like proper maths, but not many of us working out lengths of triangles in later life. A few people do, but you know, it's the underlying thinking might be useful, but the, you know, knowing your trigonometry is not the most essential life skill, whereas knowing your decision making and your percentage is much more fundamental, basic concept, is very important.
I have a friend who is very much into Pascal's fractals. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from there has actually devised an entire program of the decision-making process. And, mm-hmm. You know, and it is all kind of mathematically based, you know, mm-hmm. Whichever way he puts anything, the math always proves to be right. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's the thing about math, isn't it? Is that, like you gave, you know, with that little test a moment ago, very often there isn't a wrong answer. Well, let's say the answer is right, but the approach to the answer is different.
Yeah, I mean, that is certainly true. You know, that puzzle was maybe slightly atypical, although there were, you know, one had to justify an answer in every way. But yes, often the most creative part of mathematics isn't the final outcome, it's the way you get there, and the fact that there are often 100 different ways of getting there, and it can be really interesting to discover how someone else solved a problem and discover they did it differently from you. And of course, one can say some ways are more efficient or whatever, but you discover different things depending on whether you solve a problem numerically or with a diagram or in lots of other ways. And I think that's one good way in which the teaching of maths in schools has improved. The way children today are learning it is there's a much greater realization that there's more than one way to do it. Whereas I think when I grew up, no doubt your experience was similar, we were taught a method. This is how you divide, this is how you multiply. And I was fine, I could do it. But I never understood why it worked, it just worked. And but if I wanted to try another way, I'd have been told, no, not allowed to do it. Which was very constraining for, I'm sure, lots of my peers who probably needed a very different way of approaching some of those problems.
Well, you know, we have here that you can't go to university. I'm in North America. You can't go to university if you don't have math. And yet, you know, somebody maybe doing art or, you know, doing something totally and utterly different where they're not going to use the regular math.
Yeah.
Where, you know, if the math was a little more broad spectrum and they understood how to use the math in, you know, their passion, you know, in what it is they're going to go and study further, it'd be a lot more comprehension, and obviously they would have passed math.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a real tragedy. In the UK, it's now compulsory to continue studying maths in somewhere or other to the age of 18, or they're trying to make that. And if you fail what's called the GCSE, age 16, you have to retake it until you pass it or until you leave school. And as a result, we've suddenly got hundreds of thousands of teenagers who fail, in fact, probably in the millions, who failed their GCSE, who are now sitting in college, age 17, thinking, well, I've failed at this all my life, and I'm having to do it again, and I still don't know why I need to work out the angle on this triangle, because I'm going to be a hairdresser.
Right,
and they've got
exactly.
a real point.
Exactly.
They've
so
got a point.
The
and there's
broken.
No joy and no beauty in it. It is just, I have got to tick these boxes.
Right.
What is the point? There is no creativity in it whatsoever. And there is no, well, you know, I can see how they can justify that there is no point in what they're doing. And I feel for them. And I spend quite a bit of time now with their teachers talking about, you know, that really difficult age group, the disillusioned 17-year-old, how can you make maths real for them? And the way to do it is to connect it to problems that they care about.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the point, isn't it? As you said, a hairdresser. Yeah. And, you know, well, a hairdresser is going to know how to have to, you know, mix hair colour, you know, the ratios and this and that. Mm. So why aren't you speaking their language? In that way, they're going to grasp it more. And if they grasp that, they'll feel more confident to grasp outside of that spectrum. But when you feel make them feel dumb and stupid because they're not getting that math that has no relation to, you know, how their brain works or what they want to do, then they shut down because they feel stupid.
There is a brilliant American former teacher called Dan Mayer who did a TED talk that got millions of views a few years ago. And I have very much adopted his approach, which is to start off with older teenagers with an image, a curious image, and one that comes to mind is this picture of this photograph of these shopping trolleys that have been assembled in a car park, and there's about, well, it looks like several hundred of them in a big circle. You're kind of thinking, who's done this, or whatever. And then you see this image, which is very striking, and then you say, okay, what's the first question that occurs to you when you see this? Maybe discuss with your neighbour what it is. And they could, and some of them will say, I wonder how many trolleys there are. Some might think, you know, is it a circle or is it not quite a circle that these shopping trolleys are formed? But one of them will be asking the question, I wonder if that person lost their job for doing that. You know, so, and it's like, and you suddenly realise, the thing is, they're asking questions that they care about, and you take that as the springboard to, and you take one, if you're doing a maths lesson, you kind of want to do the maths question. So you say, okay, well, let's take the how many there are. How do we work out how many there are? I don't know how many there are there. So you together decide what maths you actually need to figure it out. But it's from the springboard of, we're all kind of interested because this picture was weird, and we want to know the answer now. It's not like a maths test where we've opened a book and there's an answer in the back. So I love that creative approach and you know, working on the human impulse to say, you know what, I kind of care about this because it's a bit weird, and we're debating it, and we're creating the maths ourselves, which is a far more healthy way.
Well,
I think,
it's that big word. It's interesting. If it's not interesting, you're not going to retain it.
Yeah.
If it's interesting, it's got you engaged.
And you know, let's get away from maths for a second and just talk about life.
Yes.
And problem solving in life, because I often make this point to school teachers who you know have produced so much on problem solving. I say the fact is when in life there's a problem, we only ever solve problems that we actually care about. So my car is making a bit of a squeaky noise at the moment when it goes over speed bumps, but I care about it being resolved, but I don't care enough to want to open the bonnet and find out. That problem will get solved by the garage. I'll take it to a mechanic to fix it. You know, I don't care about fixing it myself because I'm not interested in car mechanics. Well, you know, that's one of a whole shed load of problems we all have where we're actually not that interested in it, in the problem itself, and we'd rather someone else do it. Well, of course, sitting in a class, you often don't get a choice about that. But we are motivated to solve problems we care about solving. And often we hide behind moaning about life, you know. Oh, why is there never a parking space? Why is this? Why, isn't it awful that no one does washing up? And I sometimes, in fact, so in you know, the book that I've just got coming out, the Any Ideas book, I talk about the difference between problem solving and moaning, which we might think our moans are problems, but often a moan is simply a chance to blame someone else. It's not, there's no ownership of the fact that I want to solve that problem. You know, if I say, oh, why is there never a parking space? Well, what can I do about it? And often, you know, I don't want to do anything about it. I just want to complain that it's someone else's fault. Right. I think it's quite good finding ways to turn moans, which are problems you don't really want to solve, into problems you do want to solve and that you have some control over, some influence over. I can't change, you know, to pick a random example, who is the President of the United States. So it's not really a problem, it's a moan, or it could be, depending on what my politics were, but there are things I can do in other aspects of my life that I can, you know, influence.
Exactly. I want to talk about patterns, you know, because a lot of people see things in patterns, you know, and colour. You know, mm-hmm. it's, you've got certain people could see the hues of a colour, You know, they can see kind of the number of that colour, so to speak, without the number actually being there. And they can see the dimensions and the depths and the different, you know, contortions of patterns, and they see a picture in there that others can't see. Is that because it is kind of a mathematical mind that is seeing these patterns in a different type of way? A different type of mind?
Well, if it is, then it's a different mind from mine. When I see a colour, I see a colour, but there's certainly things going on in the brain there. There is a fascinating phenomenon, and I've known one or two people had elements of this, called synesthesia, where a colour has a particular... Well, actually... It's the other way around. I have a friend who associates certain colours with different musical notes. So when he has an F sharp, it's purple in his mind. He's actually seeing purple, you know, and a C will be green. And he says, absolutely. And different numbers have colours and so on. Another person I've met had that. So that's the brain wiring in very interesting ways, which just goes to show that there are some weird connections going on there between different senses that we're getting, between different patterns that we're seeing, and what gets fired off. There is an interesting, I mean, there's a part of the brain that is associated with the fingers, and I believe it is true to say that that is also closely connected to our ability to count and to recognize basic number. And we call numbers digits, and we call fingers digits, and that's not a coincidence, because the two are connected. That you count on your fingers, and that's the way we built. That's our little, you know, abacus that we've been set up with. So the brain is picking out, and you know, these number patterns, everything else, and is making all sorts of associations that are very complex, and I don't really understand. But it is a whole fascinating area in its own right, and you know, one to be embraced, you know, to tap into the fact that this happens.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, you know, like a musician, as you said, where the musical notes will paint its own picture, and then for an artist it becomes music, you know, through the art. And I think it's just that translation, isn't it? You know, I need color in my life. I hate the black and white, it's too sterile for me. So
and the very fact we all have these different experiences just is a good reminder we shouldn't be judgmental about what we think other people might be seeing or feeling when they see a certain pattern, or just because something's obvious to me because I see a pattern doesn't necessarily mean you're, you know, we might be seeing the same things but interpreting them in totally different ways. In the same way as a child will look up at a cloud and see, you know, Mickey Mouse, but someone else looking at the same cloud will see, I don't know, a banana or something completely different, because the brain is incredible. I mean, the human brain generally is amazingly good at seeing patterns that aren't even there, and is quite suggestible too. I'll tell you a weird way that this is manifested. There is a genius called Scott Kim, and he finds ways of taking any name, any person's name, and writing it in such a way that when you turn it upside down, it still says that name. It's the same. And you'd think, well, letters look a certain way. An S looks like an F, and an S looks like an S. Well, bad example, because S is the same upside down, but a T looks like a T. And yet, he's exploiting, in a very clever way, the fact that our brain will look for patterns. And so it wants to see, you know, Fred Bloggs written one way. I'm looking for Fred Bloggs now. I'm interpreting... You know, so our brains are incredibly good at identifying patterns that are there, that are very well hidden, like handwriting. But it can sometimes go wrong when we look for patterns that aren't there, and we read meaning in when there is no meaning. So Scott Kim is very good at the spotting patterns that are there. Patterns that aren't there, the interesting mathematical thing there is to do with, for example, coincidences. We will see some events and we'll assume there's connecting. We'll look for a pattern and say there must be a meaning behind that. There must be a meaning with the fact that these three sites archaeological sites are in a straight line, and there must be some mystical explanation behind this. And many people have made fortunes out of picking out patterns and saying this must mean that we were invaded by aliens or whatever, when in fact these are completely random patterns that we happen to have, you know, we're looking for what is not there. And it's both delightful that that happens, but it's also a problem. It's a reason why we often make poor decisions in life, because we assume we've seen two things that happened and we assume it's a trend. You know, two people who happen to have a similar background get involved in some circumstance, we extrapolate that to say, oh, all people like that must be criminals or whatever. We're seeing a pattern that actually is not true.
Now,
our brains,
you know,
are being too good.
I'm a personality patterner. So, you know, through your name, you know, through your birth date, your view of life, and also your personality traits, I look for the common denominator, the synchronicity of the pattern within that. You know, it kind of never lies. You know, that, you know, our name could be, as you say, Joe Blogs, we could be doing this or that, but when it comes down to it, that thread between everything will always be fundamentally your building blocks, your DNA imprint. And when we understand that, of course, we actually then understand how, you know, why we're here, but also how we interact with life, how we perceive and receive our information. So sometimes actually identifying your pattern is very, very beneficial to you, isn't it? Because it shows you how you learn, how you absorb information.
Well, I mean, and it's certainly true that, you know, it could be a bit shocking actually when we suddenly discover, oh my word, I always do this the same way, or it maybe takes somebody else to point out a trait that you have because you don't notice it. You know, do you know you always tail off at the end of your sentences like this, or whenever this happens, your reaction is always to tell the story about that, and it's because we're being triggered, and we react in, yeah, we do react in certain predictable ways that we'd all like to think we're entirely spontaneous, but I suspect, yes, underneath it all, we're all we've all got certain patterns are driving us, and those patterns have come from a past experience and everything else. So in a way, it's both good and bad that we become a bit predictable. You can see, and it means, you know, if you get home and things aren't in the normal position that they normally would be in the kitchen, you can kind of get a sixth sense almost. Something's happened here, because this never happens normally. So, you know, why has the saucepan suddenly been done this way? And, you know, it's a sign that something's wrong, or that someone else has been around, or whatever.
But it's also, if you identify your pattern, you can understand, okay, I'm too comfortable in this pattern, you know, and I had the capability of kind of stepping outside of that comfort zone and pushing myself a little further. Or maybe I'm one of those people that needs to stay in that parameter, because pushing myself further, you know, makes me too insecure. So, you know, I think it's kind of knowing too how far you can actually go by kind of knowing your own trait and your own pattern.
Well, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, and when it comes to coming up with something new, coming up with ideas or whatever, we do all fall into traps and we think in a certain way. And what it's really interesting that there are methods that you can use to force yourself out of your conventional pattern, which may well be uncomfortable a lot of the time, but sometimes it's harmless discomfort, if you like. There's a classic sort of brainstorming technique, which I've used many times on my own, I've used with other people as well, where you're trying to, let's think of a routine thing. I'm trying to think of a present for my wife. You know, chances are I probably have a certain pretty stock set of approaches I will use to try and think of a present, and it will get a bit stale as an approach. So the random element is to flick through a book and find the first word, you know, on page 803 in the dictionary, the first noun. And let's suppose it's, I don't know, steeple, a church steeple. Suddenly, I've got to think of ideas for a present that are to do with a church steeple. What could that possibly be? I mean, I've got no ideas other than I've got to incorporate that somehow into this idea for a gift. So maybe we could go on a tour of a church. Maybe we could go on a tour of one of the big churches in London. Or maybe What else do steeples make me think of? Something long and pointy. Maybe a steeple's a bit like, a needle. Maybe we could do something involving sewing. You can see where it's going. I mean, that random seed has suddenly set me off in a completely different pattern of thought, because it was not associated with the way I normally think.
Right.
And that's good. I mean, that's good for fresh ideas, even if there's a moment of discomfort, because you think, well, I was never going to incorporate a steeple into this process before.
But, I mean, you've written a book, you know, out of the box. You know,
which is under its new, and right, I 10 years ago I did a book called Out of the Box, which was like a prototype, which I would say do not buy Out of the Box. But 10 years on, I was given a chance to rewrite it, and I completely rewrote it. Well, I say completely rewrote it, I just restructured it and threw in all the bits that I wanted to have there and got rid of all the bits that an editor had imposed on me, and we've retitled it and repackaged it to call it Any Ideas? ?
Mm-hmm.
A bit like what you'd say to someone else. I'm looking for ideas. Any ideas?
Mm-hmm.
?
Mm-hmm.
And it's much more what I wanted to do in the way of a creative thinking book, because it's relevant to absolutely anyone, because we all face situations, routine and otherwise, where we're looking for ideas. So it's a book about having ideas on your own and having ideas with other people.
You know, when you have an idea and you want to share it with somebody and get their opinion, and then they have another idea back, and then, you know, it broadens out into something that really could become tangible. You know, when you think about it, there is an underlying mathematical equation that's going back and forth here until you kind of get to that math that now you can apply to.
There is. Well, there's also another rather more negative thing that you can model mathematically is when it goes wrong, you get what could be termed a negative feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
Because the biggest problem with having ideas with other people is that our natural instinct when we see something that's unfamiliar is to say, oh no, that's no good, because it's not familiar. So we tend to criticize ideas that are new, and as a result you and I are having ideas and I'll say, why don't we do this? And your first reaction, if it's a new idea, will be, oh no, we couldn't do that because when you've done that to me, I now feel defensive because I thought my idea was quite good. So when you come up with an idea next, my best way of reinstating my status is to tell you why your idea is no good. So we get drawn into this horrible negative cycle, which in a domestic situation is where many rows come from. But, it's just completely defeatist and it's horrible. But you know what? That is, I would say, the norm. People often don't get into rows about it, but I'd say most of the time when someone gives someone else an idea, that idea is ignored, dismissed, criticized, and set aside. And if one is looking for more ideas, that is probably the most significant negative influence on the whole process. So identifying that it happens and then thinking, how can I get around that, is vital. And this is ideas in any situation, including problem solving, including solving mathematical problems, mm-hmm. you know, where you think, well, what's the way of doing it? Let's have an idea. And for many years, in a completely non-math sphere, actually, I used to run creative problem solving workshops for managers, for government workers and so on, you know, often working on quite tedious problems, but the same phenomenon was there. Someone would offer an idea, someone would criticize it, would all be killed off. And one of the most useful approaches for encouraging ideas was a very simple, it feels like a game, but it was a behavior to program into yourself, which is when you hear an idea, grit your teeth and say three things that you like about the idea. I like that idea because it would be, it would certainly solve my problem, it would do, maybe it would save you a bit of money, and you've got to think of a third thing, which is always the hardest. And only when you've said three things you like about the idea are you then allowed to say why you don't like it.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to do, but if you have to do it, if you force yourself to do it, an amazing thing happens, which is you suddenly begin to realize this idea you thought was stupid has got some potential after all. and you begin to think of ways of developing that idea and taking it on. And the other good thing is, the person who gave you the idea, who you've just said three nice things to, feels good, and so they will tend to be more nice to you. So that horrible negative feedback loop that I talked about before gets reversed, and you start being constructive with each other. And it is the nicest creative feeling. Anyone who's is familiar with having ideas with other people will know that lovely feeling when you're in sync with the other person, when you're building on ideas, when you're laughing.
Sorry about that, folks. We had one of those usual drops, and we caught him right in the middle of talking about ideas. Let's keep that flow going, and you know, let's turn on those ideas more.
Of course, when you've had a break like that, that's ideas definitely do flow. So if you've got some discontinuity, your brain goes in a completely different direction. But we were talking about the positive influence on ideas of being with someone who is like-minded, who is supportive, who's someone who is positive back to you, which is, you know, we can't always find people. Yeah, it's stimulating. We can't always find someone who will play that role, but you can sort of simulate it by, if you can, enforcing some sort of rule whereby you are constructive in the way you give feedback on ideas, and you expect that of the person you're discussing ideas with. But sometimes, in that particular behaviour, you just have to take the lead. The person who is reacting to ideas can set the tone by being constructive. And occasionally, I do manage to force myself to do that. To get out of normal dialogue mode and into, right, whatever they say, whatever I think about it, I'm going to be constructive, try and say three things I like about it, and reboot the conversation.
And also, I think it's a good idea sometimes just to kind of, I've been looking for a service that I'm needing, you know, to do with Self-Discovery Radio, because we've outgrown our particular platform and we want to expand. And so in looking for somebody, you know, I have the idea what I want to do. But yeah. I've spoken to various people and shared my idea, and they've come forth with their ideas. And then if you write it down or you document it in some way, and then kind of sit back and look at those ideas, you know, who's that person that really sees your idea and can match it or, you know, exceed it? And sometimes we need to take that information, step back and look at it from a different perspective.
Well, that is a really interesting point, actually, because when you are in the process of having ideas, there is a tendency to just be in the flow and just go with the idea straight away. And perhaps one of the most important things, if you want to turn an idea from just a nice notion into something you actually do, then one of the best tricks out there is to sleep on it, to actually go away, especially if it's an idea you think is particularly brilliant. Because how often is the idea you think now is brilliant, you know, not nearly so brilliant when you wake up the next day?
Or you realise to implement that idea is just, you know,
yeah,
just
exactly.
Too far
and you've
out
got there. You've got caught in the flow, and it's horrible to stop and think it might not work. But actually, your brain's very good at digesting, and it works the other way around too. So sometimes an idea you think is hopeless when you slept on it turns out to be quite good, which is a good idea for not instantly dismissing ideas, which is what we tend to do. There's a lovely bit of wisdom from the ancient Greek Herodotus. He was a historian who was made famous in a film, The English Patient, a few years ago, which I think won Oscars. But anyway, one of Herodotus' pearls of wisdom was talking about how, I think it was, Greek generals should make decisions. And he said, you should always make a decision when you're drunk and then think about it again when you're sober. And if you still think it's good, then do it. And likewise, if you make a decision when you're sober, get drunk and then think about the decision again and do it. And you know, it's not the alcohol that's significant here. It's the fact that he was basically saying what we've just been saying, which is you just need to step back and see it from a different point of view, and that it really helps. Sometimes that is good enough to do that on your own, and sometimes, you know, the best way of getting a different point of view, of course, is to ask another person, but you want that person to give it a rounded view, not to be purely positive and not to be purely negative, but to come up with, you know, what they like and then what they might do suggest you do differently.
Right. I mean, you can start off with a brilliant idea and then you just look at its application as going to be impossible. But that doesn't mean the idea was. What you have to do is kind of break it down, right? And look at, well, what can be done? Where can the start be?
Exactly. And, well, I think it's quite an interesting exercise for anyone who's interested in ideas and being creative to sort of think back, you know, through life, what you can remember of it. What was the best idea you had? What was the worst idea you had? And can you remember any cases where you had what you thought was a bad idea, which actually turned out, it evolved into something really good, and vice versa? You know, at the time it was hard to know what was going to turn out well and what wasn't, but you know, I've done, you know, a few. Of course, the easiest good ideas to remember are things that turned into a thing. You made something, or a particular action. But sometimes it can be, you know, I made a decision to do this and it turned out to be a really good idea, you know, good for my life, and that was an idea to do that, to go on a holiday at a certain place, or to change job, or whatever it was. But it is, you know, if you have had an idea that had a great, you know, outcome, it's quite interesting then to sort of think, well, how did that start? Was it perfect all the way along? And for most people, certainly if I think about one or two of the projects I've done, which I've been very happy with, they had lots of stumbling blocks along the way, lots of blind alleys, things I did badly. You know, the first book I did, which did really well, which is a book about the sport of cricket. But the first draft I wrote of that was truly awful. And but it was a brain dump. You know, I got it all down on paper. And once you've got all this rubbish down, it's really good for, you know, almost like fertilizer to help grow good ideas out. But I remember showing that to a friend. And he gave me a, you know, he just took me apart, saying, look, frankly, this is the most tedious load of rubbish I've seen. He was a bit harsh, and I went away with my tail between my legs. But actually, it really helped me, because it completely forced me to rethink it. And it turned out into a successful product. Right. Well, the idea was good to write the book. First implementation was poor. I had various other, I mean, I was turned down by lots of publishers. So there were lots of failures, and is it worth it in the middle, but the end product was great. But you know, these things rarely go smoothly, and of course I've had quite a few other projects, including a couple of book ideas which I thought was great at the time, and they've completely turned into nothing. So you know, those are important too. You have to, in order to have successes, you have to have failures as well, I think, unless you're very lucky.
Well, any genius isn't a straight line, you know, and you know, everything has a wave, right? And so you ride that wave, and sometimes it connects and sometimes it doesn't. You know, terminology, it doesn't add up, you know, and it's like sometimes you get all this information and you go, oh, you know, I don't know, I hear what you're saying, but it doesn't just add up, you know. That's when you're just not feeling the connection, things aren't coming together to make that equation. And that's something we really need to kind of listen to too, isn't it? Because obviously we need more information in order for it to kind of, you know, I get it.
And it's interesting too, you know, one could be very rational in saying, well, this is good, this is bad, or whatever, but sometimes there is this, I mean, I think it's probably is still rational, but it's more buried away, you know, this hunch. I've just got a hunch that person won't work well in this project, and that person will. And you think, well, you know, black and white, if I was explaining to someone else, they'd both sound equally good, but something's telling me I shouldn't go with that person. I quite often, you know, operate on that basis. If I'm finding a speaker to speak in one of our shows we do for schools or whatever, and it almost feels unfair, because you can't quite articulate to that person why you don't think they're going to be good. But you kind of know. So hunches are an interesting
part. Inner math, right?
Yeah.
There's an equation going on inside of you. You may not actually
see it. There probably is. It's very, very complex interaction is going on, and you're just reacting to what, you know, all this a combination of maths and I'm sure biology and psychology and everything else are all stirring together.
Right. Well, you know, as we said, everything is kind of mathematical, so even, you know, even our own chemistry
is.
But, you know, you've done another book on brain teasers and things. And, you know, we talked earlier about keeping the brain alive, you know, by doing things like people who do puzzles, you know, Mahjong, you know, the Chinese Mahjong, wonderful game, people who play games. It's keeping the brain active. So it's really important that we kind of find something that teases our brain and keeps it going, because after all, if it's not used, it just stops working.
It does. And puzzles are one way of doing that, not least because the thing about a puzzle, what defines a puzzle is it's a mystery. You're kind of stuck and you're thinking, well, if I apply my normal way of thinking, I'm not getting anywhere with this. So what's the aha moment? So you're forced to play and come at things from different angles, and that must inevitably sort of be firing neurons that weren't firing otherwise. It's giving you a jolt, and you know, you will tend, I mean, everyone's different, but if there's a puzzle you can't do, often it'll be churning over in your mind, you know, for quite a while until you come back and look at it again, suddenly that aha moment. And the aha moment is a great feeling, and of course it's one you get if you solve a puzzle, and it's one you get if you have an idea. The two reactions are, it's the same reaction to two apparently different things.
And don't be despondent if you're not getting it. You know, maybe that particular puzzle isn't for you, there is something else. Or maybe somebody comes along and says, yeah, but have you seen this bit? And once you see that, everything else falls into place. You know, and
it's interesting, There was, of course, this is a visual puzzle I'm picturing, but I'll tell you the story behind it. It was a matchstick puzzle. You know those matchstick puzzles you sometimes have? Turn this shape into that shape by moving one match. And I was with a group of friends. This was a few years ago. We were in a pub having a drink, and I got this puzzle out and showed it to them. Can you make this donkey face the other way? It was a donkey made of matchsticks. It was really interesting. I've never forgotten the way they reacted, because they kind of sat looking at it, and then one of them picked up a matchstick and put it in completely the wrong place. But because he did that and got it wrong, someone else suddenly saw something that they hadn't otherwise seen. So it needed the first person to have a go and do something completely wrong to actually help all of them to spot what the right solution was. One of those friends, probably the brightest of all of them, didn't get it, however, because they weren't revealing to each other that they'd solved it. And a couple of days later, he needed me to tell him what the solution was. And the interesting thing was, he said, I tried to do it all in my mind. I felt like it was cheating to move one of the matches. And yet, to me, it was vital you move one of the matches. The whole point was, have a go, fail, and learn from the fact you've just failed. It's actually a really helpful thing in solving problems, is to you learn by having got something wrong just as much as you learn from having got something right. And that little example has always stuck with me, that you know, your intelligence will only get you so far. You can't get it right all the time.
That's the ego coming in, isn't it? Which, you know, is driven by insecurity. And, you know, the thing is I don't consider failure is when you tried something and it didn't work. I don't consider that a failure. I just consider that a lesson learned. I think the failure is when you stop doing something altogether, when you've given up. You know, we're meant to get things wrong, because then we understand, well, that didn't work, let's try something else. Well, that worked here, but it didn't work there, so now let's try something else. And it really is putting that puzzle together until you've got the whole picture.
Absolutely. There's a quote from, it may be apocryphal, but it sounds right, Thomas Edison, who was trying to find what the best filament was when he was inventing the light bulb. And he notoriously went through all these different things. Does it work with wood? Does it work with steel? Does it work with glass? And all these kind of things. And, you know, he was having all this frustration, but he made the comment, I haven't failed. I've just found 700 ways that won't work.
Right.
You know, just this lovely sense of, well, look, you know, just keep on trying, and every time it fails, actually, I've learned something new, and that is lovely. And there was a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, I think he was, called Linus Pauling, and his quote was, if it can come back to me. It was sort of related, because he said, if you want to have good ideas, you have to have lots of ideas. Mm-hmm. So it was almost implicit. You will have failures. There will be lots of rubbish in order to get the good stuff.
Well, it's like, as you said, when you're writing a book, you know, you put everything down, and then really now it needs to kind of go in order. It needs to find its flow. It needs to find its story thread. And you can't expect that first draft that you've written to be the bestseller. You know, that's purely the ideas.
And funnily enough, it's a tip. Before I'd written any books, a tip that my brother gave me, my younger brother, who said, you know what, the most important thing in any creative project is to just do something. Mm-hmm. When it comes to writing an article or a book or anything, just write down something, anything. It could be the last chapter, it could be a sentence you like. And the very act of getting something on paper, however bad it is valuable, because it's begun to get your juices going. And I've never forgotten that, and it has been very true for me. And I have in many cases, in having written 12 or 13 books, been completely stuck. So I thought, you know what, I'm just going to spend the next hour just writing any old rubbish down, even if at the end of it I'm thinking this is terrible. And so often that has been a useful thing that just pushed me to the next stage. And I guess, all of my stuff has been non-fiction work, but I guess novelists are the same. There must be some wonderful torn up versions of Harry Potter and everything else out there that were necessary in order to produce the finely honed product that we all got to see at the end.
Yeah, my brother is a novelist, an author, and I remember in one of his books he had got himself into a pit, and it took him a week to write himself out of the pit. And we've got to realise that when we see all these sometimes brilliant movies or scripts and books and things like this, is that the mind, I'm always thinking this, the mind behind that, the mind that wrote this. The way they see patterns, the way they can weave things together. It always intrigues me, because it's like, wow, how do they think? How did they get to that? And
it always astonishes me how many people are able to write good novels that are structured, just because that's something I am really, I have always struggled with, fictional writing or whatever. I've never got very far with the notion of writing any kind of novels. I have a huge admiration for people who do, but the intricacies of the plots holding together and the logical flow and everything else, I mean, one can analyze them and say, well, this works because A is followed by B, C, and so on. Of course, it's very tedious when they're deconstructed like that, but it's fascinating. But it's brilliant, because they have to be flawless, these books. They have to, otherwise the reader will say, well, it's ridiculous, so-and-so said whatever, but that can't happen because they hadn't met the person until this section of the book. You can't fool an audience. Yeah. But presumably to come up with, I know that some novelists and some comedy writers actually produce huge charts of logical flows to work out the plot. I think that's how John Cleese used to write Fawlty Towers episodes with his wife. Here he was producing a classic comedy series for TV, but he was doing it in a highly analytical way, saying this will happen here and therefore this happens here and the consequence is this. It would look more like a sort of production diagram for
and he got the laughs.
But in a very serious way.
Switch it over to kind of computers right now, because everybody thinks computers is just XO. And, and everybody also thinks that it's just kind of nerds and mathematical minds that can, do programming. I'm not designed for programming. I have hard enough time just doing anything. But would you say that you do have to have that analytical pattern analysis, mathematical mind to do all the... this programming that they can just do with such ease, they can do with such speed?
The interesting thing about computer programming is when they've looked at people's ability, even people who are in the profession of computer programming, the effectiveness of the best people, the most productive people, compared with the least productive, is in the ratio of something like 100 to 1. So someone might have a job as a computer programmer and might be sat next to someone who is actually 100 times more productive than them, which is phenomenal. So everything is on a spectrum, and but in the end, to be good at that, you do need, you have to have a degree of, you have to be methodical and to have a sense of logic and structure and so on. Interestingly, although it's a while since I've done any computer programming, I was good at some aspects of it, but not so good in others. I was quite sloppy in others, and not so in a way, quite creative, and I didn't have the discipline necessary to produce these very efficient programs. I'd have been towards the bottom end of that spectrum of 1 to 100, which is why I didn't turn into a computer programmer, I guess. but there were there were connections. You were seeing, I wouldn't take it too far, but people who have got mathematical skills will have a lot of the ingredients for being able to sit down and turn something into a computer program. But of course, computer programming has revolutionized anyway, and continues to in the last 20 years. So it's so different from when I was doing it. And, they talk about us being about to effectively be taken over by robots. It's got so far that now computers are being programmed to think like people, to be fuzzy, to connect things in across different ways, and are beginning in certain circumstances to look and sound a little bit human, which is quite scary, really, because it's challenging the whole notion of what it means to be a person and what we're useful at. But the thing that will always make us human will be certain aspects, the way that the organic brain works, and things like emotions and laughter and experience and so on. And there's only so far, I hope there's only so far, that computers with their written logic can go in that. We're doomed if they can really become human.
Well, one of the things that humanity is having a problem right now is becoming very robotic. A lot of people aren't connected to the heart, the spirit, or the soul, and have kind of become very switched off and in themselves. Yeah. And a lot of them are walking dead. So
I saw a cartoon yesterday, actually, of this robot talking to a guy in an office saying, we robots were supposed to be taking over, but your work is so boring. Actually, we've decided not to bother. But there we are.
That actually is funny and scary at the same time. Yeah.
Anyway, it's ultimately, yes, it's the question no one has got to the bottom of yet. But will it ever be possible for a computer to have a soul? What does it even mean? I mean, it's great. It's great that we can, the very fact that we're able to ask these questions is what makes us human, I suppose. Well,
if you remember Robin Williams, is it the Millennial Men?
It rings a bell, but I didn't see it.
Yeah, he lives like 200 years and end up creating an entire industry where he creates organs and parts for the human people, but he actually did develop a soul and a heart. For the love of one of his creator's children, right from the word go. But he was flawed. They were going to throw him out because he had emotions. And the owner decided to keep him, and that's what evolved from there. Beautiful movie, highly recommended, actually.
Right.
Let's talk about your books and how people can get hold of them, because you have so many here, and they're all kind of different, so there isn't, one size fits all, so...
Sure. Well, so my most recent one is Any Ideas. All of my books are available through the usual online channels, which I guess is the easiest way of getting them. So Amazon and other bookstores and stuff online is the easiest way. Certainly Amazon in the UK, because all of them are published in Britain, but some of them translated, some of them available in the USA. in the UK edition. So Any Ideas, which is just a book about having ideas and the whole process, and about, it's dotted through with puzzles, because I just think puzzles are a great way of illustrating the way we think and how creative thinking happens. The others of my books that I think people would enjoy the most, so of my mathematical books, the first one I wrote with a friend of mine, Why Do Buses Come in Threes? It's just the maths of everyday life, everything from coincidences to how escalators get jammed and all these kind of things. So that's a quite accessible book, and it doesn't require too much mathematical thinking. And I wrote another one which is even more generally accessible, about maths of everyday life, called How Many Socks Make a Pair. And then two other subjects I've written about. One is, I've always been interested in memory, and it's connected to a lot of what we've been talking about already in a way, but memory is fascinating. Well, memory is fascinating for children. For parents, it's, for adults, it's normally a source of anxiety. So I've written two books about memory, one for adults called How to Remember. But in a way, that was, you know, sort of, don't worry, you're not losing your memory, and here's a way to keep it fresh. I quite enjoyed writing that one, but I far more enjoyed writing the one for children called How to Remember Almost Everything Ever, because for children, memory is just a fascinating experiment, because it is possible to remember so many things and to use lots of creative visualizing techniques to remember bizarre facts and to play with the way the brain works. So although that was a book written for children, it's one of those family books that actually a lot of parents will secretly read it and think, you know what, actually I quite like this, because it's telling me how to remember a shopping list and people's names and stuff using lots of silly techniques. So that one's How to Remember Almost Everything Ever. And then the first book I wrote was on something completely different, and mentioned it earlier on, a book about cricket, the sort of originally English sport that sort of travelled across the British Empire, that has always confused Americans stereotypically. What is this weird thing that English people do that looks a bit like baseball, but is totally different and doesn't seem to finish? And I, that was my very first book, and I wrote it partly because even in my own cricket team there were other halves who just didn't understand what was going on. So I thought, I'll write the book to explain the laws of this bizarre but wonderfully rich and humorous sport in a way that people can understand. And the book called What is a Googly, which is just one of the things in cricket, is a googly. And the whole thing is built around questions, questions that people ask me. I spent about a year talking to Americans, my Spanish plumber, anyone else who would speak to me about what they've always wanted to know about cricket, like why do they all wear white and things like that. So the whole thing is structured around questions I was asked, and that that's what set me off writing books in the first place. So it has a particularly special place in my heart. And that book was published in 1992, so it's now 25 years old, which is great, and still in print.
Great.
So
that's really good. So yeah. I mean, you know, obviously there's books here for anybody, really. You know, you've got Math on the Go, and you know, Math for mums and dads, and then basically anybody, you know, there's a book here that you can gift to someone, because you've got Math for the Teenager, you know, the Hidden Mathematics of Sports. I mean, really, you've kind of hit the ball out of the park, so to speak.
Well, there we are. Yeah, certainly lots of Christmas present ideas.
Birthdays, Christmas, and everything else. Yeah.
Well, you know, I the current thing that connects them all is I like writing about things that I'm interested in, because I want other people to be interested in these things too, so that we've got something to talk about. So that's what's driven me to do all of these things.
Well, I mean, it's. Math is intimidating if you're not mathematically minded. And, you know, we need to take that intimidation out of it and make it more invitational, make it more how to use it creatively, and then we won't have the stigma and this frustration with math. Mm. You know, it can become something that's fun, and not something that makes you, you know, feel stupid or just it's just so overbearing, you don't know how to use it. So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, this is, I think, anybody who's maybe struggling with math, this is, you know, great to kind of give them any one of these books to help them on their way.
Sure, yeah, that's the aim. And, you know, when it works, when someone says, oh, that really helped, you know, that is a great feeling to think, you know, you've made life a bit easier and more enjoyable.
I mean, when you do learn more from kind of like the story or the connection, you know, or the, you know, the application as opposed to, you know, the dry formula, you know, we really do need that creative stimulation to kind of get it, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah. And we need to play, that's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, people are natural, you know, play is a natural way of learning and behaving and so on. So if one can make any topic playful, it's just so much more accessible.
Well, I've got a couple of people I can see already here on the birthday or the Christmas list. I know that we'll get a kick out of it, so for sure. So can you tell also people how they can get hold of you on your site or book you for any
engagements? Well, yeah, it's very straightforward. So my website, and you can contact me via that. My website is just, you don't even need the www. That's Rob Eastaway, which is east as in west and away as in going away, so eastaway.com. So simple, robeastaway.com. And that is the best way of getting hold of me. I'm on Twitter as well, at Rob Eastaway. And I'm reasonably responsive on Twitter as well. So those are the two ways that I communicate with the world, except via books.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I mean, this is, you know, the me doing a show on math, you know, people be laughing, but you know, it's how to make math fun, you know, which you know, in my world has not been. And and of course, if you talk to somebody that's generally very mathematical, they just look at you as if you're an alien. Why don't you get it? So it's a delight to speak to someone who actually gets it, who can translate the language into something that makes it easier to learn and easier to apply, which was something that's very much needed. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
So thanks for being with us, and to everybody else, a lot of answers here, a lot of fun, a lot of, you know, testing your own self and, you know, your own puzzle equations and looking at any of those ideas, all of this could be very good stimulation for yourself as well as for somebody that you know. So give a gift to yourself, pass out the gift on, and help people kind of overcome the difficulties and the stigma and the whole approach to math. We can all be brainiacs, we've just got to know how to ignite our brain. So thank you very much, Rob, and to everyone else, bye for now.